international detective dragons from outer space.
Space. I'm Anima 5, and thank you very much for downloading and listening to episode 29. The topic for this episode will be responses to episode 27, Mr. T's letter, religion, and the Adam and Eve story. We'll have other emails as well from Nev and Sarah and Mick Bradley, a new member welcome to the Frapper Map, real world experiments in perspective that you can do yourself. All that and more, right after this.
Now, try this new way to accent your figure. Cross your heart, see? You're suddenly shapelier. Well, that's what this new Playtex Fashion Magic Cotton Bra does. It crosses your heart with stretch to lift and separate. You're suddenly shapelier. This cross-your-heart shaping is only on Playtex regular fashion magic bras and new long-line styles. Cross your heart. You'll be shapelier, honestly.
It's the top of the show, and I think just as always, I'll begin with a Frapper Map welcome. We now have, within our refined and cultivated group, Dirt Merchant. Dirt Merchant had this to say upon placing his pin in the map.
Lurking since the tavern promos.
Well, fortunately for us, Dirt Merchant lurks no more. Dirt Merchant from Salt Lake City. You know, lurking can be very tiring and injurious to the lurk muscle group. So bravo. And if anyone is at all curious about Dirt Merchant's choice of handles, well, write in and ask, because I have no idea. But before you jump to any conclusions that no one can make any money selling dirt, I would invite you to check out the World of Warcraft auction house prices on Deep Rock Salt and on Goro Soil. Yikes. I don't know if Dirt Merchant has anything to do with that or even plays World of Warcraft. I'm ignorant of that. But I do know that he has joined the Frapper Map, and so thank you very much indeed. Dirt Merchant, welcome. Next, a quick note from Mick Bradley of the House of the Harping Monkey.
Anim. The Richard Carney stuff you put in my path is priceless, invaluable magic. Thanks so much for pointing it out. I've been discussing on the Gamer the Podcasting forums about the similarities between religion and role-playing, and Carney may be just what I needed to clarify my thoughts without even realizing it. Thank you. Mick.
Most welcome indeed. I'm very glad you were able to check those interviews out. And if you out there listening haven't yet, be wise and download them now. That's CBC Radio, their podcasts. They're an interview with Richard Carney. I've already put them in the Gudikatinkatungatungs twice for last episode and this and the episode before that. But I'd recommend you go and download them now because I've been back to that link I placed and I've seen part one disappear and reappear on that CBC page. That's supposed to hold all three parts of that interview. It may be gone after a few weeks. So just get them onto your iPod or your hard drive or disk or flash drive, whatever. Keep them safe until you can listen to them. Richard Carney's ideas are worth exploring. And you may also want to check out that thread on the Gamer the Podcasting forums. It's under the Philosophy of Gaming section, and the thread topic is named
Religion is RPG, RPG is religion, oh my.
Lots of interesting ideas being exchanged there, and it's worth a look. And you can, of course, reach the House of the Harping Monkey and Gamer the Podcasting through their permanent links on the IDDFOS homepage. Have I mentioned how to get to that lately? It's www.anim5.com. Once that page loads, it's smooth sailing. Sarah from Does My Geek caught news from me that I'd likely be recording off-site soon, and I might as well share with you that Might as well share with you now. Yes, the frothing rapids of the holiday season also includes my getting out the cardboard and printed scenery, and it's time for me to begin making more Christmas, children's show scenery. I build children's show scenery during these months. And that'll mean some long nights. On occasion, they can get tedious, but I'll break that up with my usual random conniption fits, and I'll try and hit record before those occur. And I mentioned at some point in an email that I might attack Dr. Smith again. And Sarah wrote,
"Those who wish to vote for Anna attacking Dr. Smith again, vote aye."
And she followed it up with an enthusiastic,
"Aye."
All in caps. Well, I suppose I could. But after all the lofty topics that IDDFOS has attempted to cover so far, wouldn't that be a step backward? I mean, we've moved into philosophy and theology and eternity. Oh, hell, I'll attack Dr. Smith, I guess. I'll attack more than Dr. Smith, I bet. When it gets to be about 1:30 in the morning and I'm not even halfway done with the stuff, I get very erratic. And I could just detonate on any topic. Could be interesting, lost in space or no. I could go off and make wild generalizations like adults don't feel injections, they don't hurt as much. I got an email from Nev of Does My Geek pointing out that there may be some flaws in that statement. Nev writes,
"Hi, Adam. Nev here. I was just listening to number 28 on the way to work, and I thought I'd share my response to something you said. Apologies if the quote isn't quite exact. Adam 5. Injections don't hurt when you're an adult. You can barely feel them." Nev, "What? Are you crazy? They're like red-hot needles being plunged into my flesh. I have to lie down when I get an injection just to prevent me from hitting my head when I pass out. It's bad enough that they stick me with a bit of metal, but what really makes my flesh crawl is the fact that they then push it along the vein. I can feel the end scraping the walls of the blood vessels as it worms its way through my body. Don't hurt. Barely feel them." My fellow commuters were somewhat shocked. "Hope you are well. I'm still loving the show. I particularly like the music at the end of number 27. Do you have any idea what it was? Oh, and that comedy sketch about the angels of death was so funny. Please, can we hear more? All the best, Nev."
Well, I've already written back to Nev acknowledging with a bit of embarrassment that it was kind of a dumb statement to make. I can't assume that about all adults, that needles or injections just don't hurt as much. And further than that, everybody has a different level of pain sensitivity for all kinds of different things. Perfect example for me would be dentists. I wrote this back as well when I responded to Nev. If a dentist is 60 miles away from me and just glances at my dental chart or my dental x-rays, if I'm sitting at home on a normal afternoon, I will suddenly fall out of the chair, screaming in agony, clutching both hands over my mouth. I'm exaggerating just a tiny bit, but dentists and I never in my life ever got along. It probably has something to do with another doctor that my mother brought me to when I was a wee little Adam 5. One of those situations, I think, where you're losing your baby teeth. This was one of those old-style, country, old-school, whatever. Dentist walks in, feels the loose tooth, grabs it, yanks it out. That came as a shock to the system. Yeah, I should trust this guy. How did I get off on that? I was about to talk about the music you mentioned. Yes. At the end of episodes 25 and 27, there's some really gorgeous pieces that I played, and I don't truly know their actual original source. I'm just going to read what I put in the Gurukatingatangatungs about both of them. "Hauntingly beautiful and unknown in origin, the chain of custody for it goes back to 1987. I was working as an assistant technical director for a summer event at Liberty State Park. where free theater was being presented in a restored train terminal. The audio engineer was playing a series of these. They do sound checks, by the way. Audio engineers need to do a sound check in whatever space that they're putting up a public theatrical new sound system with whatever. They have to do a white noise check. They have to do a balance check in between shows when they're setting up whatever. They play music if they can in between asking people to go up on the stage and check the microphones. Sorry, that was useless for you to know. But this is what he was playing. He was playing these nautical folk sounding compositions. And I asked him to make a copy for me, and he went right ahead and did it. Nice quality, high quality cassette copy. He told me they were composed especially for a production that he had just worked on. I don't remember the name of the production. It was at some university. I don't remember the name of the university. It was in some state. I don't know which state. I can clearly picture the audio engineer's face in my mind, and I can't remember his name. I swear to you, I was not taking drugs, and I'm not taking drugs now. I just don't remember, but I kept the cassette. That was in 1987. That was 20 years ago. Have I got a hope in hell of anybody identifying this stuff? Maybe. Not likely, though. It is nice music, though. It's very, very, very pleasant. So, yeah, the possibility of finding the real source of the music from 20-year-old cassette and from a guy whose face I can remember but not his name, it's pretty slim. But in the meantime, I'll just share the music with you. And that Angels of Death bit, that little snippet from the old-time radio show for number 27, well, you can indeed hear more. Anyone interested, whenever you hear a little snippet from an old-time radio show, check out the Gooditkatinkatongatongs, because you'll find the link to the radio show that it's taken from. And it's been that way ever since, actually, the first one. But I haven't made mention of it. I think I just made mention of it on that and then never actually clarified what it was I was doing after that. But that clip is from a series called The Berkus Way to Dynamic Living. The episode, I think, was entitled Gain Spiritual Fulfillment or something like that. But it was the late 70s, very funny radio show from the United Kingdom. So, sure, check out the Gooditkatinkatongatongs for episode 27, and you'll find a right-click save as link to that radio show. So thank you very much indeed, Nev, for responding. Sorry I pushed you to it with a silly generalization that didn't much make sense. I know what it's like for me. I don't know what it's like for everybody else. But it really was wonderful to hear that you got back home safely. It was also extremely enjoyable to hear about your trip, as you told it in the last Does My Geek. I felt very proud and special for being a part of it. And, oh man, Fistful of Comics and Games. Guys, I've been watching your episode availability like a hawk, waiting. What you need to know, folks, is Working Man and Tangent, JJ and Victor, brought the same ultra-cool audio setup that they used at Gen Con. To me, it was ultra cool. I mean, I had this little stick digital thing, whatever. But when we all met together for breakfast at the TikTok Diner, they brought out this really sleek. It's an iRiver. It's an iRiver with a input for four high end clip on mics. So they had. I mean, they basically had the best audio for that meeting. For the breakfast that we all had. Game of the Podcasting, Fistful of Comics and Games, and Does My Geek, and yours truly. And then they just posted, this is what got me, sorry, I just detonated. They just posted this notice that they won't be releasing any new episodes until like November 29th. Oh God, I can't wait to hear it. Guys, you got the best audio, but I know what it's like. I talk about rapids in the holiday season. I know what it's like. And I should talk, right? I let two whole weeks go by without saying anything. But really looking forward to that, what you guys do with it. So what was I talking about? Oh, glad you're home safe. It was fun to hear about your trip to the States. Okay, where do I go? Where did I get to? I don't know. I guess that means it's time for a break. Back in a bit.
For a real-life drama, it's hard to match the climaxes that come in the vital business of developing and producing life-saving medicines. When penicillin was first produced, for example, penicillin mold showed a discouraging tendency to blanket the broth in which it was grown, to shut out oxygen and restrict the development of the whole culture. With countless thousands looking to penicillin with new hope for better health, perhaps for life itself, a way had to be found to speed the growth of the mold. And a way was found. It was discovered that penicillin mold could be grown faster in huge agitating tanks through which oxygen constantly bubbles. An example of the value of constant research and experimentation. The House of Squibb, through nearly a century of seeking perfection in the production of life-saving drugs, has won the confidence of your doctor. And you may share that confidence, for the same quest for perfection is behind all the simple health necessities Squibb makes for your home medicine cabinet. To be sure you get Squibb quality when you buy, always ask for it by name. Ask for Squibb, a name you can trust.
Okay, on now then to the main body of episode 29. Now, to double back to 27, I've got to make clear of a couple of things. One was a misinterpretation that I had of a line from Mr. T's letter, and it was a simple transposition of a word. What Mr. T meant to write was, no major religion is by nature directed towards evil intentions. He didn't actually mean to write, no major religion by nature is directed against evil intentions. That's where the confusion came from. And in an email reply, very shortly after the episode, he did make that correction, sent it to me, and I put that in the Kutikatingatongatungs as soon as I could. But I figure it's good to put that here. The other clarification I need to make is that I didn't actually do what I should have done, specifically in terms of Mr. T's letter. I read the letter, but rather than respond or understand what it was he was trying to say, I just put out whatever little minor confusions I was having, specifically about the Adam and Eve story, viewed in the light of the most recent revolutionary ideas being put out by the Anthropic Network, subsequent to the novel Ishmael by Daniel Quinn. That isn't actually what the Norwegian Viking was going for. What he was going for was, as far as the Adam and Eve story was concerned, and this is how he got it across to me, I believe, and how I should have actually seen it in the first place, was contrasts. Knowledge of the good and the bad, the highs and the lows, contrasts. The Adam and Eve story as a parable, in his view, in his interpretation, was a choice being offered to the human race by the creator of the universe to either remain in the steady state that they were in or be allowed to see all of it, be allowed to see the good and the bad, be allowed to make the choices between the highs and the lows. Would they be able to? And the questions that this posed for him were, can a human being actually feel greater joy if they've experienced greater sorrow? And pretty much that sort of question all along the line, as far as the opposites go within human experience. So that's, I think, what he was trying to get across, or at least that's how he indicated to me in a subsequent response. So I really should have seen that. I really should have understood that the first time I read it, rather than having my own particular theories on the brain and technically not responding to the letter that was written, but rather to the subject, to the subject line of the Adam and Eve story. And I'm going to try not to do that again. And I did kind of this. I did pretty much the same thing to Derek when he wrote in about, in the last episode, when he wrote in about the economics, the possibility of using the idea of gift giving on an escalated scale or with different interpretations to move us in the direction of greater wisdom. I only latched onto a tiny portion of something included in his email rather than really listening to what he had to say. So I kind of missed the boat on his email as well. But we'll have corrections to that and responses to that in episode 30, which will be the 30 Theses Anthropic Network episode. Once again, folks, I'm sorry. I'm just... I'm going to read the letters because I haven't written out anything for this show. I haven't pre-written responses or ideas to get across for this show. I did record something off-site that's going to come at the end. That's the perspective experiment. But the emails for this particular episode are extremely lengthy, and they're going to take up a good portion of the record time. So I'm just going to go ahead and read those rather than give any kind of input from myself to take up even more of your time. Let me begin with this response from Kurt the Camera Guy. And he writes,
"Hi, Adam 5. Here is my 2 cents worth on the topics raised and things mentioned in episode 27. First and foremost, allow me to thank Mr. T for the passionate and thought-provoking email. I agree with much of it, including the idea that you cannot tell whether someone is good or evil purely on the basis of their professed religion. However, since a proper exchange of ideas requires different ideas, I will concentrate this missive on where I may have a different take from Mr. T or yourself. Oh, something else I should take care of before I get elbow deep in this discussion. I'm sure the guys over at Domain of Apocalypse would prefer that you play a copy of their current promo, since they have changed formats since the one you played in episode 27. They still do some industry news, and the bulk of the show is a radio play, one of their games, which is pretty good and getting better every episode. One of the things that Mr. T mentioned early in his email was the religious hatred that has spawned since 9/11. I would like to point out that Western Christians have not cornered the market on religious bigotry. Far from it.
I see that you're in complete agreement with Mr. T on that.
The people corrupting wise words of the prophets, Christians and Muslims alike, to serve their own personal goals, that is an evil act, no matter what religion you have. For quite a time prior to 9/11, since the end of colonialism actually, it was and remains a capital crime to be anything but a Muslim in many Muslim-ruled nations. While there are certain areas which might be intolerant to other faiths in the Western world, I don't believe there is state-sanctioned murders of people for merely being another religion.
Damn. Can you please forward a list of those countries where you can be put to death for not being Muslim? I wonder whose purpose that serves.
As for the choice we would all make if the Creator came and asked us if we wanted the knowledge from the tree or not, I know most of the people who listen to your show would surely say emphatically, yes. As a matter of fact, I would even bake apple pies for us to eat on the stratospheric veranda, and we'd all be drinking cider as well. But there is a fairly large percentage of people, in our country at least, I can't speak for others, that don't seem to want to know what is going on. Ignorance isn't just bliss to them, it's a way of life. We all know them, the people who can tell you who won every season of Survivor, but can't tell you who is the Speaker of the House, or who we are at war with, or how the economy is actually doing. So I pray, if we are ever given the choice, that it is on an individual basis, or one of these sleepwalkers could mess it up for the entire species. The idea that human beings are at their best after a tragedy dovetails with something I talked about a bit during our 3-episode discussion on man's place in nature. Human beings are designed to work best in a crisis atmosphere. Is it any wonder that his best traits shine through when doing what he is best at? The idea that the good works that are done in the aftermath of catastrophic events are extraordinary is a contrast to what modern man's default setting seems to be.
Egad, I'm sorry, Kurt. I screwed that up so bad. It took me 8 tries to get that sentence right.
I think this portion of the conversation would be best examined from the opposite direction. Why can't man maintain his humanity for extended periods of time after such an event? Why is the average for many, though obviously not all or even perhaps a majority, to insulate themselves so far from their fellow man as to not even notice them?
That's an excellent question.
On the topic of evil being done in the name of religion, I could not agree more with Mr. T. Those who engage in this practice are the lowest of what humanity has to offer. And all the major religions have had people who have preyed on the true believers in this manner. A brief glimpse into the horrors of the 30 Years' War that raged across Europe during the 1600s will show how destructive this practice can be with the deaths of millions in Central Europe. The excuse they used was a disagreement on how to worship the same deity, though it was mostly Europe's nobility vying for power and prestige and using religion as a mask. Over the centuries, very few hands are clean.
That's for frackin' sure.
However, there is a stark contrast that can be drawn in 2 recent modern illustrations of religious leaders taking advantage of their positions to do evil. On the Christian side of the ledger is the Catholic priest sex scandals of several years ago. While they obviously abused their trust and their faithful, and even some of the senior clergy tried to hush things up, the upshot was that the average parishioner, the true believers, if you will, rose up and said they were having none of it. Those priests that were involved were drummed out of the priesthood. Some were prosecuted because they, members of that religion, said that this was unacceptable behavior. Now let us look at the elephant in the room, shall we? We all know what is happening in the world around Muslim extremism. I realize that the vast, vast majority of Muslims are not involved in any way, shape, or form with the hideous acts that are being perpetrated in the name of Islam. However, where are the masses of true believers from this religion denouncing those who do condone the practice of killing innocent civilians in the name of their religion? The voices are few and far between. The saying goes, all that is required for evil to triumph is for good men to do nothing. Yeah, I know, Churchill again, but the guy really had it on the ball. So that's where I would draw the distinction, and will continue to do so until those good people take their religion back from those who have hijacked it, like the planes of 9/11.
Now I've got to stop here and ask for a different contrasting example here, Kurt. I can't really use those realistically to come to a conclusion I'm satisfied with. I mean, for the Western Christian side, you have a religious constituency that's rising up in protest against proven sex offenders and pedophiles found to be in positions of responsibility and power within their churches. Yeah, they raised their voices and they took a stand, but how hard was that? I mean, it's practically a no-brainer. Were they standing up for their faith? Sure. Were they risking anything in particular by doing so? I guess they were. They were risking exposure to yet more ridicule from the outside, but I see an imbalance in the example. On the Middle Eastern Islamic side, you seem to be looking for dissenting and courageous voices among a people who've lived for generations with an ingrained fear of opening their mouths for any reason. Outright public denunciation of the splinter groups and the nut jobs that have just blown away their cousins down the block would pretty much mean they put themselves and their kids next on the list to either be blown up or to be kidnapped. Is it morally wrong to be afraid? I don't know. I know one thing. If I was in that position, if I was in their position, I'd be a coward. I'm not proud to admit that. But I, for example, could never hide a camera under my veils like some women did in Afghanistan when they smuggled that video out that showed the brutality going on over there way back. I I just think your example is a little weak. I understand what you're saying, but I also wonder if there are a few more voices rising up out there than we know about, simply because the Western cameras aren't being pointed at them. And if we're looking to hear from Islamic groups in the U.S., again, what cameras are being pointed at them? Are newspapers covering what they have to say? And besides, what are Muslim people in the United States going to say? You know, what really are they going to say? While we're at it, which subsect of Islam are we talking about? I haven't even begun to understand the intricacies of how often Islam has split apart, rejoined, altered, specialized. There's too much to read about for a quick and simple answer. That's just like with Christianity. We've got Catholic, Protestant, Lutheran, Episcopalian, Baptist, Mormon, Eastern Orthodox. I'm ignorant of all those distinctions. And I speak English. I think I'm running off track here. Back to Kurt's letter.
I agree that we all want a better world. There's no disagreement there at all. The one thing that Mr. T might want to keep in mind is that there are many different ideas about what a better world is.
Why Mr. T in particular? Shouldn't we all keep it in mind? I know I will.
This is another whole potential topic for the show, I would imagine. While many of us see a better world as one where we can all live our different lives harmoniously and without fear, others might only think the world is better when we are all the same. While we might think that a better world treats everyone equally and encourages people to pursue their dreams, someone else might have the idea that a rigid caste system, without even room for women in it at all, might be the best. I think we sometimes misunderstand that everyone in the world wants the same things that we do because of our frame of reference. And at the macro level, it is likely true that everyone wants that better world. However, the details are where the devil lies, and they make all the difference in the world.
That strikes a little bit of a chord with the email from Direwolf that we'll hear later on. That truly is a sticking point. Who decides precisely what's a better world? What does a better world mean? Here's something I wanted to read that I'm just going to throw this in real quick. I wanted to read because you reminded me when you mentioned a caste system with no room for women. It reinforces your point about what a better world might be and for who. Now, this is a kind of a dogma or a doctrine, too. Check out this list of commands for women. Accept your husband at face value. Don't try to change him. Admire the manly things about him. Don't show indifference, contempt, or ridicule towards his masculine abilities, achievements, or ideas. Recognize his superior strength and ability. Don't try to excel him in anything which requires masculine ability. Don't let the outside world crowd you for time to do your homemaking tasks well. Work for inner happiness and seek to understand its rules. Don't have a lot of preconceived ideas of what you want out of life. Revere your husband and honor his right to rule you and your children. Don't stand in the way of his decisions or his law. Interesting. Very interesting. It comes from a book called Fascinating Womanhood by Helen B. Andelin. And it was first published in 1963 here in the United States. Within my lifetime. I was 3 when that was published. I guess a lot of what each individual in each society believes to be normal depends a lot on what time it is. I'm sorry, that was a gross interruption. I will continue.
One thing you said in your closing that got me to thinking. It's always been a mystery to me. While many of those who profess to be the most devout in any particular religion seem to be the least able to withstand any challenge to their faith, they cannot have any other faiths around them. In the case of many Muslim or atheist leaders, and yes, atheism is a religion since they have faith in the absence of something, or cannot engage in debate or conversation, in the case of many fundamentalist Christian leaders. I have fairly firm conviction in what I believe in, but not a zealot by any stretch. And I'm more than happy to have a discussion on any topic of faith. or anything else for that matter, as my voluminous emails to this show will attest. Though I will call him as I sees him, and you should be ready for that when we sit down to chat. I seriously doubt you will change what I believe, but I'm willing to talk to you about it. Just please keep it lively and interesting, which thus far Mr. T's letter has been, and I'm sure this conversation will continue to be. Best of days, Camera Guy.
Thank you, Camera Guy. Important points to make, and thank you for writing them. I've gotten plenty of fascinating topics from the Camera Guy from just a few emails past, and you folks haven't heard them yet, so look for more of those to be discussed in the future episodes. Next, we'll hear from Dire Wolf, who sent in an email taking a very brave stand and getting across some ideas that I think might not be popular, but I think he spoke his mind regardless. And I hope I didn't mess up completely on my interpretation of what he was trying to say. But, well, that's right after this. Back in a bit.
The old Kraft Music Hall grabbing a shortwave boost to our fighting men all over the world. You know, it's increasingly amazing to me how many ways are granted us to give them a boost. For instance, waste kitchen fats. Certainly nothing to us, but they're a vital ingredient in the manufacture of high explosives. That's the stuff that's rocking our enemies right now, fore and aft. The OPA has now authorized your butcher to pay you 2 brown points for every pound of fat you save. 2 brown points and 4 cents in cash. That's certainly pretty good pay for helping to win the war. So keep rendering the fat, pouring it into smooth-edged cans, and bringing it to your butcher. You collect 1 brown point for every half to three-quarters of a pound, 2 brown points for three-quarters of a pound to a pound and a half, and so on. These points will be good for any meat or fat purchases, so get your fat in. It's vitally important. To waste fat is unforgivable. To waste anything is setting a horrible example.
Next, an email response from Direwolf, and he writes...
First of all, thanks, Adam Five, for the compliments and recommending to others my myth from Misfit Brew. It was really cool to unexpectedly hear my name mentioned.
Most welcome. In fact, if there is something I should know about other members of our Frapper Map as far as other displays of talent or appearances, websites, and the like, let me know. I only had news about Jim and Direwolf last show, but I'm sure there's stuff I'm missing about other listeners that are on the Frapper Map.
So my mind went on a little journey generated by the question, can you tell if someone is good or evil by their religion? And I thought I would share. I disagree that it is a given or that it is a rhetorical question. I would submit that you can in fact do so, but not really in the way that I think is being forwarded by the letter on your show. I am not making a statement that some religions are evil and some are good. I am saying that there are some consequences to deeply held beliefs, as well as consequences of having a system of ethics and morals.
I'd agree there. There are consequences. The Holocaust leaps immediately to mind.
So, to try to avoid getting too much into one religion versus another, I'm going to go with a kind of Socratic tact and try not to make any examples, which might make it more difficult to get some of what I am thinking across. I think it is unfair and incorrect to downplay or trivialize the power and impact of religion on people. I think this making light of religion sometimes happens with a belief that everyone should hold any religious beliefs they want.
I have to pause there and ask, what would be the opposite of that belief? A belief that, no, everyone should not hold any religious beliefs they want?
Religion does play a central role in people's lives. It is important and does say a lot about a person. Religion speaks to basic ideas and morals and the way a person defines humanity and our place in the world.
I think I'm in agreement with you on that.
So, first of all, I would say that you can judge a person a great deal by the religion they practice and how much they embrace and live by that religion. It is not like a favorite color or deciding what to eat. Your religion, if it has any meaning, has ramifications on the self.
I've got to pause again, Direwolf, just so I'm not putting words in your mouth and just so I'm fully understanding you, do you mean to say judge a person by their religion? Or would the word be characterize? Or would the word be identify? Frankly, I find even characterization and identification to be on dangerously inaccurate ground, but I'm interested to know for sure if you meant judge.
Now, religion is generally hard to define, but for this question, I'm going to make a general assertion that religion has doctrine and dogmas, which defines a particular moral and ethical framework for believers. This can be simple, complex, rule-based, whatever, but the idea is that religion has basic tenets of faith that the believers accept. And these tenets speak to the nature of humanity, the world, and indeed good and evil.
I think I'm in agreement with you on that, too.
So if a person has embraced a religion, and with it the moral framework of that religion, then they have a system by which they can judge and define facets of life. This includes the ability to tell if another religion and the people of that religion are, by definition, good or evil.
What? I'm sorry, Direwolf. I read those last two sentences a couple of dozen times, and I keep looking for some indication preceding this or following this that you believe this to be an error in reasoning. If you don't, fair enough. I just want to know. And then I read the sentence that comes after it.
It is the nature of religion to give us an understanding of right and wrong. And so with that understanding, we can see that right and wrong in other religions.
Okay, a variation on the preceding statements. I wonder, though, if it's necessary to embrace any specific religion or if it's possible to be an atheist and still have credible and accurate sensibilities of right and wrong or good and evil. Well, whatever the case, I find myself disagreeing with that idea. But that's where a lively exchange starts, so we'll continue.
Could the story of the apple and Adam and Eve be looked at as perhaps a metaphor for this idea? The apple and its knowledge are religion, and biting that apple creates a knowledge of, and a world of, good and evil.
Now, I'm going to splice in here a section from a later email from Direwolf that elaborates on this.
What I am seeing is a possible interpretation of the eating of the apple as a comment on religion itself. God creates a paradise and warns not to eat of the fruit of knowledge, which could be considered religion. So what the Creator is warning here is not to start a religion to him. Once the apple is eaten, which means religion is created and practiced, now there is sin, shame, punishment, and conflict. For sin and punishment for sins by a god are really only possible within a religious context. And so the world falls by the introduction of religion and the knowledge of good and evil that it brings. So could the first book of the Bible actually contain a warning against religion? I find it an interesting thought.
Now that is a very interesting possibility.
Now I am going to speak rather generally, so I hope I am getting my point across without getting too hard to understand. Now, something in my experience is that there is a common arrogance or conceit that people feel that all other religions actually believe the same basic things that a person's own religion does. There is also a distaste for those that express their religion heavily and a general belief that one should not implement or act on their own religious beliefs if this comes in conflict with currently held beliefs of the society in general.
I absolutely recognize that distaste you mention. It often translates into disdain with a kind of a reverse effect of popular judgmentalism. Is that a word? Well, the biggest examples I can think of would be the portrayal of the Flanders on The Simpsons. Or also on The Simpsons, those two little brothers in Bart's class who get sent into the hall before the sex ed film gets shown. I guess the idea is we're supposed to lighten up and laugh at them and look down at them, but I guess it's not exactly the kind of religious tolerance America is supposed to be exhibiting or known for.
So what you get down to is the idea that everyone has the same basic moral and ethical system, which, of course, is in line with our personal religious one. So if another person of a different religion is acting in a way that is counter to our own, we say that that person is not a real member of that other religion, or that they are a fringe fanatic who doesn't really understand their own religion. After all, no religion would have a tenet that is not politically correct and completely in line with our own sensibilities and religion.
Well, I plead 100% guilty to that. I think I mentioned in a previous podcast what I thought the core message of all religions was. Treat others as you'd like to be treated. Things are not as important or valuable as people. And submit to the will of God. I'm willing to admit that they may have been oversimplifications and inaccurate. But I think it may be valuable to review. I may try to do this for myself, I don't know. But I think it would be valuable to review not only the definition of the word religion, but the underlying purpose of religion. And to recognize that there are, in fact, there have to be variations in human interpretations of just what the will of God is. I personally don't believe that it's ever been possible for any human being to know that, but that's not pertinent here. To continue with the letter.
So I see a contradiction of this with a common ideal that we, and I am speaking mostly of Western American ideals because I happen to live here, and I am interested to see if this is common elsewhere, believe in diversity and differences, yet we deny that there can be a difference in moral and ethical thoughts in other religions. If there is going to be diversity in spiritual ideals and beliefs, then there may be religions out there that will have a different concept of right and wrong. The question is not if we can see evil in others based on their religion, but instead, have we gotten to the point that we can accept that others are indeed going to have beliefs they feel are good that we consider evil? And can we point out the difference without offending and also accept the difference without always wanting to destroy the other? And no, we probably are not, because I think we can all think of things that are unacceptable regardless of a person's belief. Then again, is that really best? Or is this an example of the current anti-hatred and trying to be tolerant and open as a childish dream? I have heard sermons on the danger of tolerance.
The current anti-hatred and trying to be tolerant and open is a childish dream. Dangers of tolerance. This is where, Direwolf, this is where I really would like to hear examples. I apologize, I'm not following here. Are we talking about a diversity in spiritual ideas and beliefs, or are we talking about something else? The question I think I heard first is, this is my take on it, this is what I think I heard. How can we say we celebrate and accept everyone's right to practice the religion of their choice if we deny that there can be religions with tenets that have different ideas from ours of what right is and what wrong is? The next question I gather is, have we reached the point where we are forcing ourselves to accept and tolerate, again, religions with core tenets that mandate evil actions? I hope you can see where and why I'm getting muddled here. You began early on in the letter with a statement, I am not making a statement that some religions are evil and some are good. But the exploration here seems to take us precisely to that conclusion. I hope I'm not totally messing up what you're trying to get across here. But if I'm interpreting this correctly, I'd have to say, no, we don't have to tolerate evil actions. Evil actions are performed with intent. I'll borrow from one of my own definitions of evil. The use of people through deception for the purpose of seizing power and positions, or for the purpose of deriving personal enjoyment and gratification through the suffering of others. The cruel and deliberate spread of pain and despair, whether or not the power and possessions are obtained. Evil does not happen, it is chosen, practiced, and intended. Now, to me, direwolf, that falls outside my definition of a religion. And on a group level, what that becomes is somebody's political or economic agenda. And on an individual level, it becomes a symptom of mental illness or simply somebody just being an asshole.
So should we run from conflict and violence or accept that there is conflict and we should be warriors for our faith and what is right?
I think I've hit the core of the email here, and it's a bunch of explosive questions rolled into one. Should we run from conflict and violence? Which conflict and which violence? And is that conflict and violence actually motivated by religion, or is it motivated by economics and political oppression or expansionism? If we're talking about war, then my opinion is we've stepped outside of and rejected the core message of what I believe religion is to espouse. And we become soldiers in some geopolitical or power-hungry, agenda-driven conflict. And that doesn't just go for today, that goes for whenever throughout our history. And we can paint a deity's face all over one side or the other. It doesn't make it religious in any way. Should we be warriors for our faith? Who is we? And warriors in what way? And which faith? Christianity as a whole? I would submit here that the truest and most effective warriors of the Christian faith are the ones that have sold everything they have, given it to the poor, and are working daily in a local homeless shelter, helping people to get off drugs or alcohol, and teaching kids to read. I don't have that kind of bravery or moral strength. Warriors for our faith and what is right. Right according to who? Again, as you pointed out, and as we heard earlier in Kurt's letter, this can be a sticky and ambiguous question, depending on who you are, what you believe, and where you live. It's a very loaded sentence, that one. I really would like a departure from the Socratic tact you mentioned. Concrete examples would probably keep me from straying like this. I'm sorry, Direwolf. He continues.
Can we accept people that are this way? What I am seeing is that we need to decide some tough things about religion and what we are willing to let religion be in people's lives.
Again, I'd have to ask, who is we? And if we means society as a whole, or even any specific religion setting itself on one side or the other, when could it ever become their responsibility or even the right to decide such a thing as to what religion can be in other people's lives?
Are we so comfortable with the general consensus of ethics and morality in society, again, Americans specifically, others can speak to their culture, that really we want a need to neuter and sanitize all religion, removing the moral component of their teaching? I see the idea that religion is really just a candy shell around a center of morals and ethics as dictated by the society at large. You can choose the coding and its rituals and holidays, but the morals and ethics are exactly the same. Funny. I don't see many religious people accepting society at large dictating their morals. Or are we going to have to accept that there will be good and evil, as we each define it, and that is acceptable? Are we going to accept that we can believe others are evil, and they can believe us to be evil, and yet we understand both sides can live their faith and express their beliefs? Should we accept it?
I guess what I'm hearing here is that the morals and ethics dictated by society at large seem to be in extreme conflict with the vast variety of moral components within all religions, and that to apply the societal norm to all religions is to neuter and sanitize them. I think the unasked question here is, can ethics and morality be something that's determined by general consensus? But leaving that aside for whatever stack of books it would take to answer that, if the societal norm is that it is wrong to beat people up or kill them whenever you like, take whatever you want from whomever you want, or smash and destroy anything you happen to see that you don't like, or gather up a group of people and enslave them to serve your own needs. Are we really sanitizing or homogenizing Christianity, Islam, Hinduism, Judaism, etc., into some plain, amorphous, undistinguishable whole by assuming that those things are held to be wrong in all those faiths?
Are we going to accept that we can believe others are evil, and they can believe us to be evil, and yet we understand both sides can live their faith and express their beliefs? Should we accept it?
The key words in that sentence are others, us, and evil. As soon as we apply the label evil to the collective others, then those individuals are no longer people. They become a concept. They become an abstract dark force or enemy. 14-year-old Harry from Piscataway, who happens to be Jewish. 26-year-old Bill from the Bronx, who happens to be Muslim. 22-year-old Louise from Modesto, who happens to be Catholic. They're all now nameless and faceless as stormtroopers. And the label that's been applied to them, evil, makes them okay to kill. This is the same twisted non-logic that murdered so many people on 9/11 and is currently painting the walls with body parts on the other side of the world and getting students and teachers killed when some sick bastard brings a gun to school here in the U.S. Now, if that kind of thinking is overlaid onto religion, it distorts it and corrupts it, no matter what shape the building is that we pray in. It works both ways. But to answer that particular question for myself, I don't know about anybody else, but yes, I can recognize the fact that there are individuals doing evil acts all over the world, rich and poor, male and female. Can I directly connect those evil acts and those individuals to the core morality and ethics of an entire religion because they profess to be practicing it? Can I use their particular examples of stupidity as the paint to apply to the whole society? No, I can't do that. To me, there's a separation. I guess that either makes me naive in the extreme, or just completely blind and backwards. Maybe I'm just too sheltered to recognize this. But if some moron camps outside an abortion clinic and blows the doctor's brains out, and later it's reported that he was claiming to follow his fundamentalist's beliefs, am I supposed to conclude that all Christian fundamentalists are gun-toting murderers? I could be in complete agreement with you here, Direwolf. I just may be reinforcing your point. I confess, I don't know. Maybe you can straighten me out on this. I'm sorry, my interruptions have been just rampant in this one. I'll continue.
Now I am going to suddenly shift topic here. I have a story which relates to the idea of people acting good or humane after a disaster. It is a minor event in my life, nothing like a disaster, but it meant something to me. In my previous home, we had poor drinking water. So we would buy jugs of water. The cheapest thing was to refill jugs, and because we lived 40 minutes from any place we could fill a jug, we brought several dozen jugs each trip to town. So one time, it was near Christmas, and I was busy filling my many, many jugs when a woman came with only two jugs to refill. I stopped and said that she should go ahead. She seemed shocked for a moment and said, "Thank you. It must be the Christmas spirit." I kept quiet at the time, as she meant nothing by the comment, but it annoyed me. It annoyed me because I was simply being kind and courteous. But rather than the fact that I could be good, the fact that I did something was relegated to the fact that it was Christmas and the Christmas spirit. My ability to be nice was robbed, and I was only being influenced by an outside force, and normally I would not be nice without that outside force. And so I realized that I think too much. But I also wondered about the idea that is sometimes put forward that people are inherently bad, and when they do good, it is God working through them or divine intervention. That seems to me to be a rather dark judgment on people and their motivation for doing good.
That's an interesting point. And I can see where you would be a little ticked off. You'd be a little ticked off at her comment. Like you, I'm sure she meant nothing by it, but you're right. It does kind of dump all possibility that you're simply a good human being. Come to think of it, what have you told her? What have you told her?
Christmas? I don't understand. What is this Christmas you speak of? I worship Cthulhu.
That'd make her spill some water, I betcha.
Love your podcast and look forward to more on the subject. Direwolf.
Thank you very much indeed, Direwolf. I hope you don't take offense at my commentary running throughout, but I really am curious as to where we agree and disagree on most of your points. Socratic tact notwithstanding, in the printed word, it can leave your message wide open to complete misinterpretation without the vocal emphasis. And a wrong inflection here and there, it could mean for a totally different point. I'm guilty of misreading or completely missing the point on several letters I've read on the show so far. So please, steer me in the right direction. If I've gone way off base with yours, please let me know. But there's some very interesting ideas there to explore, whether we agree or not, so thank you very much for that email. Next, we'll hear from Sharon, right after this.
Hi, partner! Reese!
Hi, fellas!
Roy Rogers!
Say, that's a pretty tricky hat, isn't it? Partners, how would you like to surprise your pals like that? Well, you can with my new Roy Rogers Quick Shooter hat. It's by Ideal. And here's how the Quick Shooter hat works. Just press this secret button right here, and a replica of an authentic Western pistol pops out and fires. It's your secret weapon, even when they think you're unarmed. So get Ideal's new Roy Rogers Quick Shooter hat at your favorite store today, and you'll always be ready for anything. Ask for Ideal's new Roy Rogers Quick Shooter hat.